Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, untangling the science and politics of climate change with renowned climate scientist James Hansen. Then, on the Scholar Circle, the politics of emotion. How do emotions drive political outcomes, like violence, war, and genocide? On June 22nd, the United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development celebrated its second anniversary with its second forum in Rio. Among the 50,000 participants, 100 heads of states joined with NGOs and climate scientists in order to solve a range of sustainability issues. The resulting document, titled The Future We Want, featured a range of potential solutions. Some 50 governments now have launched new energy strategies, and private investors have pledged $50 billion to help double the amount of global renewable energy production. While taking positive steps towards sustainability, critics of Rio believe it is a far cry from solving the current global crisis. Last year, the United Nations issued a report warning about potentially irreversible and massive loss to life-sustaining environments should humanity miss its emissions reduction targets. The Global Diversity Outlook indicated that the Earth is fast reaching a tipping point, a point of irreversible damage to life on the planet. Already, animals and plants are becoming extinct at never-before-seen rates, some at 1,000 times more than before, according to the UN report. Simultaneously, life in the freshwater lakes and rivers are being choked off by algae, which robs the water bodies of oxygen. And oceans are becoming too acidic and warm to sustain coral reefs, which are considered the lungs of the oceans. In 1988, James Hansen, Columbia University professor and director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, told a Senate Natural Resources Committee they should, quote, stop waffling. As the science grew more indicative of the dire consequences, the energy industries and the government attempted to muzzle public release of the science, particularly those coming from a very vocal James Hansen. Hansen, however, has been difficult to censor. His research is widely acclaimed across the scientific community, and his relentless efforts to stem disaster have been featured throughout mass media. Hansen decided to untangle the science and its interaction with politics for the public in his own book, Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. Dr. James Hansen joins us now. Welcome, James Hansen.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. So let's try to cover both the science and the politics in one interview. And let's start with the science. You have looked at Earth temperatures from as far back as 1880. How are these temperatures measured and verified from that far back?
Well, we have to rely on measurements that were made by weather stations for much of that period. And, of course, those were not designed for measuring small, long-term climate change. But they are good enough that we can infer with a reasonably high accuracy how temperature has changed. And, of course, there are many other ways to verify that, for example, by looking at ice melting around the planet and by looking at temperature profiles within the ground, because a temperature change at the surface does move into the ground, and you can actually measure in these boreholes that have been made by oil companies, other mining operations, you can measure how the temperature changes as a function of depth. So there are various ways you can get the temperature. We know that the world has warmed up by about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit over the last century. Over land areas, it's about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit. But, you know, that's not very large compared to weather fluctuations that can happen from day to day or even from season to season, year to year. And that's one of the confusions in trying to inform the public about the reality of this change. When you get a cold season, a relatively cool season like last winter, then it tends to be misinterpreted as a climate change. We have to look at the frequency. You know, that's why I used colored dice in the 1980s to try to make people realize we have to look at how the frequency of unusually warm seasons is occurring. And in the United States, 8 out of the last 10 summers and 8 out of the last 10 winters have been warmer than what was normal or average a few decades ago. So the things are happening scientifically, we can see, but communicating this to the public is still a challenge.
And is it because when you look at 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit or 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit, people generally think, oh, well, you know, 80 degrees or 81 degrees, not that big of a deal?
Yeah, that's a big part of it, because it would be true if that was the only thing changing your local temperature by that amount, then it wouldn't be a big deal. But the problem is that the climate system, we've had for the last 10 to 12,000 years a fairly stable climate, and civilization is adapted to that, things like sea level. And we can pass tipping points in the climate system where we begin to get dynamical changes occurring that could be outside of the ability of humans to control. For example, you mentioned one of them, that's the species extinction. Because as we drive some species to extinction, that affects other species because of the interdependencies of them. And that situation can become nonlinear. You can get ecosystems to just collapse, and you get a very much larger number of extinctions. And likewise, ice sheets. Greenland and Antarctica are beginning to lose mass at a substantial rate of a couple hundred cubic kilometers per year, and that rate is increasing. If it gets to a certain point, those ice sheets can begin to collapse quite rapidly, and we could get sea level rise of several meters, and we just don't want to pass that kind of a tipping point.
What is the likelihood of that?
If we stay on business as usual, the likelihood is practically certain. We know that from looking at the Earth's history. If we go back to a time when it was 2 to 3 degrees Celsius warmer, that would be about 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit, the sea level was 25 meters higher. Now, we don't know exactly how long it takes the ice sheets to disintegrate and cause a large sea level rise, but they would certainly start to disintegrate, and once that happens, then you don't have a stable sea level for a very long time, and it's going to be enormous economic and social consequences of that.
Speaking of the Earth's history, if we go and look way back and we see that the Earth had an ice age, that has allowed some people to argue, well, these things are cyclical. What is the reality with regards to the Earth's history with an ice age? What caused that, and the cyclical nature of temperature?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The temperature of the Earth has, over the past couple million years, it's been oscillating between glacial and interglacial times, where temperature changes are 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit on the average. But what that actually shows us is how sensitive the climate system is. Those changes are driven, instigated by small perturbations in the Earth's orbit. There's a very strong correlation of these changes in the Earth's orbit with the changes in climate. When you get more sunlight at the high latitudes, then it will tend to melt the ice sheets and expose darker ground underneath it. So that causes more warming. And as the planet gets warmer, the ocean releases carbon dioxide. And what we see, and the temperature changes, are then caused primarily by the changes in the atmospheric composition and the reflectivity of the surface of the planet. And we can use that information to see how sensitive the climate is to changes in atmospheric composition. And what it actually tells us is the climate system is very sensitive. It takes it time to respond, and that's what makes this problem very difficult, because the planet has only partly responded to the atmospheric gases that we have introduced, primarily by burning fossil fuels. There's more climate change that is in the pipeline. And we know this from looking at the planet's energy imbalance, because what the greenhouse gases do, like carbon dioxide, they reduce the thermal emission to space. And so we have more energy coming in from the sun than we have heat energy being radiated to space. Most of that energy is going into the ocean. So if we measure the ocean's internal temperature very accurately, we can tell how far the planet is out of balance. And what it tells us is that there's approximately as much warming that's still in the pipeline, even without any more greenhouse gases, approximately as much as has occurred already. So that's what tells us that we're already into the dangerous zone, and we are really going to have to reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere if we want the climate to stabilize.
Now, some of the people who have argued against the model that you've talked about and that has been verified time and again in the scientific journals have been arguing that the Earth will be able to heal itself, bring itself back into balance. You've talked about in your book a gentleman named Richard Lindzen. Is it unlikely? And if so, why?
Well, the Earth would certainly come back into balance. The way it does that is when it's out of balance, it's absorbing more energy than it's radiating, so it's going to warm up until it gets a new balance. The problem is that that balance is going to be at a climate which is very different than the one that has existed the last 10 to 12,000 years.
Now, talking about this argument in terms of bringing back into balance, it sounds like what you're saying is, sure, that could happen, but it'll probably happen in a long time from now.
Right. That's right. And it will happen with enormous consequences, irreversible on any time scale that humans would care about. And that's the changes in the ice sheets and sea level and the extinction of species.
You've talked about climate-forcing agents. What are these climate-forcing agents, both natural and man-made, and how do they work?
Natural ones include things like volcanoes. Another natural climate-forcing is the sun itself. It's not a constant star. It's a variable star, only slightly variable. Its energy output varies by about a tenth of a percent over a decade. But now humans have come into the equation in a very big way. We've added enough CO2 to the atmosphere, increasing it from 280 parts per million, which had existed the last several thousand years, to about 389 parts per million. And so you can compare that with the solar variations, and you see it's much larger than the natural solar variability. The volcanic variability can be as much as a few watts, but it's only there for a couple of years. In addition to CO2, we're also adding methane, nitrous oxide, chlorofluorocarbons, so the total greenhouse gas forcing by humans is about 3 watts. Humans, however, are also doing things that cause a cooling. We are putting aerosols, like the sulfuric acid aerosols that volcanoes put up, into the atmosphere in several different ways, by burning fossil fuels. It's the air pollution that you can see. When the air pollution is enough that you can see a smoggy effect, that's due to small particles, not to gases, which you can't see. And anyway, those small particles reflect sunlight, so they have a cooling effect. But now, because the greenhouse gases have a much longer life and they just continue to accumulate, we're now at a point where the human-made greenhouse gases are causing a substantially larger forcing than the cooling effect of these aerosols. So, you know, in understanding what's going on, we have to look at all these different forcings, but the bottom line is that the greenhouse gas forcing is the largest one, and it's the one that is increasing the most, and that's why the planet is continuing to get warmer and warmer.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders, Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues, and I'm Maria Armudian. We have been speaking with world-renowned climate scientist James Hansen about the challenges we're facing both with the climate and with the political environment in solving the climate issue. More on this when we come back, so stay tuned. Welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders. I'm Maria Armudian. Now, you have talked about this tipping point before federal government bodies, and the UN has released its report saying, look, we are facing a tipping point. What might a tipping point look like?
Well, that's a difficult issue to say exactly when you passed a tipping point. Perhaps one of the most important ones, and one that we can now identify and monitor quite accurately, is the ice sheets. Because we've had this satellite called GRACE, which is a gravity satellite, it measures the gravitational field of the Earth with such a high precision that you can see changes in the mass of the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet. And what we see is that the Greenland 2002 to 2006 or 7 was losing mass at a rate of about 150 cubic kilometers per year. In the last few years, that's accelerated to more like 250 cubic kilometers per year. And Antarctica, which was initially losing mass at about 75 cubic kilometers per year, is now losing it at a rate of about 150 cubic kilometers per year. Well, if that curve continues to bend down to more and more rapid rates, that will be a tipping point where it will signify that the ice sheets are beginning to rapidly disintegrate. And as I mentioned, that's a tipping point we don't want to pass, because once the ice sheets do begin to disintegrate rapidly, humans will have lost control. You can't tie a rope around these ice sheets. They're more than a mile thick and continental scale. So there's nothing you can do about it if they begin to disintegrate rapidly.
And the consequences as they disintegrate rapidly are
enormous for our children and grandchildren. We're not going to see big sea level changes in the next few years or even the next decade or two, although we can now measure how sea level is changing. It's going up about 3 centimeters per decade. That's a little more than an inch per decade. But if this rate of ice loss doubles a few more times, then you're starting to talk about sea level rise that will become very important. And we know from the Earth's history, when the ice sheets do disintegrate, the changes can be of the order of 5 meters in a century, which is 1 meter every 20 years.
So in terms of the things that we have been seeing a little bit more over the past decade, things like more intense storms and more intense and more frequent fires, are these related to climate change, or do we know yet?
If you look at the statistics, then you can say, yes, we do expect a relationship. You can't blame any single event and say, okay, this one was caused by global warming. But we can see a lot of things happening. You know, the Arctic sea ice is decreasing in area very rapidly, and we're likely to have an ice-free Arctic within a few decades if we stay on business as usual. And we do see that the subtropics have expanded. That's an expected effect of global warming, is an expansion of this circulation cell, which has rising motions in the tropics and subsidence in the subtropics, which gives rise to the dry subtropical conditions. And on the average, that cell has expanded about 4 degrees of latitude. And we can see that in the southern United States and the Mediterranean region, in Australia, where the hot, dry conditions and resulting forest fires have increased in frequency and intensity and area, partly because of that climate change. Storms is a difficult topic, except that we can say that the strongest storms are going to get stronger. That includes both the storms that are driven by latent heat, that is, energy and evaporated water, and that includes hurricanes, tornadoes, and thunderstorms. The strongest ones will get stronger because there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, provides more fuel for the storms. And also, what I talk about in my book, Storms of My Grandchildren, we will also see stronger frontal storms, the cyclonic storms, because as the ice sheets begin to melt faster, they will cause the high-latitude oceans to remain relatively cool just because of the iceberg injection into the ocean. But the tropics are going to get warmer and warmer, so we will have stronger temperature gradient and stronger frontal storms.
You've been telling this to policymakers for the past 20 to 24 years now. So the question is now, what is stymieing, or maybe rather than even asking you what is stymieing this understanding among policymakers, maybe we should just ask you what your experience has been. You testified in 88. Then the Clinton-Gore administration was not particularly welcoming, not very supportive of changing the policies to reflect the science. But then when the Bush administration came in, it seemed to have been much, much worse, according to your account and some others. You, for example, went to address the president's task force, and it included all the high-level secretaries. Why don't you tell us about that and then what happened after?
You know, you can summarize it pretty easily now that I have the perspective of looking back on this and both Democratic and Republican administrations. In many cases, the politicians are willing to accept the reality of climate change and the fact that it should have implications for policies. And those implications actually are consistent with things that we should be doing anyway to reduce our energy dependence on foreign sources of oil and other energy, for example. But what we find is that the policies that are proposed are not really successful, are not significant in actually addressing the problem. What began to be clear to me, I finally mentioned it in a talk about 5 years ago, is the special interests are really driving the proposed policy changes. And the politicians have said to me, you know, you're a good scientist, you should stick to talking about the science and not stick your nose into the policy issues. But what I've found is that if scientists don't help connect the dots, then the dots are connected in a way which is convenient for business as usual, for the fossil fuel industry, but which don't solve the problem. Because the fundamental issue is that as long as fossil fuels are the cheapest energy, then we're just going to continue to use them. Somebody will use them. And their emission into the atmosphere just continues to increase after the Kyoto Protocol.
They're primarily cheap because we subsidize them. Isn't that the case?
Well, that's part of it. One of the reasons they're cheapest is because we subsidize them. But also, we do not make them pay for the damage that they do. For example, to human health, air pollution due to fossil fuels has an enormous consequence on human health all around the planet. But those costs are borne by the public. There's no cost at all to the fossil fuel industry. That's just going to be borne by the public. And so we have to put a gradually rising price on carbon emissions. The money that is collected in this fee, which should be a flat fee at the mine or the port of entry on oil, gas, and coal, that money should go to the public. That way, distribute it monthly as a green check. And that way, the public would have the ability to adapt to the changing energy structure, invest in more efficient vehicles or changes to their heating system.
I actually would like it if you could talk about your experiences, like what happened after your presentation to some of these entities, like the task forces.
That censorship has been occurring for decades, all the way back to when I first started speaking in the 1980s. The first thing I realized was that when I testified to Congress, I found that my testimony had to be approved by the White House, which is true in both Democratic and Republican administration. The Constitution has the Congress as controlling the purse strings, and they need to get the best information, technical information that they can. But the other censorship is related to the public affairs offices, which are headed by political appointees. Again, the purpose of public affairs should be to inform the public about the best available science, not about a political agenda.
You're saying this as a result of having seen within, you said, two different administrations, the censorship?
Within several different administrations, yeah. Early in the, well, no, it was in the middle of the Bush administration when I gave a talk, which really caused some annoyance at the White House. There were then calls to NASA headquarters, and then public affairs tried to completely constrain me. I had to tell them what was on my calendar, and I could not speak to any media without prior approval. And if they didn't want me to speak to that media, they would send somebody else. So there has been a variation in how intensely they try to control the information that goes to the media, but to some degree it exists in all administrations.
How have the media been in terms of explaining the science to the public?
I've been around a long time, and I can remember back to sometimes we had report like Walter Sullivan at the New York Times, who was really super. But the ability of the media to have a staff that can report science well, I think, has decreased a lot with time. And what has happened in the last year is just remarkably bad in that, well, just look at this situation where now a good fraction of the American public, and in fact other countries too, now believe that the whole global warming thing may be a hoax.
Yeah, where did that come from?
You know, part of it is scientists are being hammered by the likes of Glenn Beck and the other people who promote this perspective. And scientists are just not very good at hitting back in an equivalent fashion. You know, scientists tend to lose in such a confrontation. But to be specific, look at one of the big issues was the mistake in the IPCC report, this 3,000 pages of report. Of course, you're able to find some flaws in that report, but the one that was focused on was the glaciers, the Himalayan glaciers, the fact that the report said that the Himalayan glaciers may all be gone by 2035. That is not an accurate statement because the Himalayan glaciers are the highest in the world and some big ones, and they're not all going to be gone by 2035. But in fact, if you look all around the planet, in the Rocky Mountains, the Andes Mountains, the Alps, the Himalayas, the glaciers are melting back rapidly all around the planet. So any scientific analysis of this problem, actually, it's a very strong indication of the effects of the warming planet. And the implications of glacier loss, once they are gone, are quite substantial because many of the biggest rivers have more than half their water from melting glaciers during the dry season. So it will have practical implications. But the story, as revealed to the public by the media, was much less concern about this such situation. The actual situation is that the data has become stronger and stronger, and yet the public got the impression that there's a hoax.
Thank you so much for your time, for your work, and for your new book, Storms of My Grandchildren, This Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. James Hansen, thank you. How do emotions drive political outcomes like violence, war, and genocide? Stay tuned.
From the pulpit, a general raised his hand, preaching violence against Islam. And so his Christian soldiers marched on and on through his killing field in the name of his God. But thou shalt not kill. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won now.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. How much do emotions impact or even dictate political outcomes, like ethnic violence, wars, or even genocides? That is a key question posed by international relations theorists, political scientists, psychologists, and communication scholars. Some of the theories relate to the emotion of fear and threat, and the idea that there is no international police force that prevents nations from attacking one another, so all must be prepared. But other emotions also lead to attack: resentment, hatred, and rage. Where do these emotions come from? How do they play out? We're joined by three experts. Roger Peterson is professor of political science at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and has authored numerous books on the subject, including Understanding Ethnic Conflict, Resistance and Rebellion, Lessons from Eastern Europe. David Altide also joins us. He's a professor of political communication at Arizona State University, and his books include Terror, Post 9/11 and the Media, Terrorism and the Politics of Fear, and Creating Fear, News and the Construction of Crisis. And we have with us Jeff Birkenstein. He's professor of English at St. Martin's University, and among his books is Reframing 9/11. I'd like to start with Roger Peterson. Can you first give us an overview about violence and emotions? And maybe you should start even with the international relations literature that pertains to fear and threat, and then bring us up to speed with what you've been doing.
I should probably mention that I have a book which is called The Strategic Use of Emotion in Conflict, and it deals with actually all the Western interventions in the Balkans, especially between Slavs and Albanians. And the premise of the work I'm doing, which builds off the Understanding Ethnic Violence book, is that the West, and by that I mean basically the United States and the European Union, intervene in conflicts by believing they can introduce sort of a rational choice game, that they can arrange sticks and carrots in a certain way to induce behaviors, and the people like the Serbs and Albanians have a little wider view of human nature, one that incorporates emotions, and they see emotions as resources. And they use emotions as resources to basically screw up the game of the Westerners who believe they're imposing a rational game. So there's certain emotions which are very powerful, I think, in being able to be mobilized as resources. Two of them relate to violence, which I think we'll probably pick up on in this conversation, and that's anger and fear. And fear is really based on the cognition that there's some danger, but anger is based on the cognition that someone's done something bad against me. And if you frame what's happened to you in different ways, you can generate either anger or fear, but these emotions, to take a big thing they do, is they shape risk perception. So if you're under fear, you generally tend to upgrade risks, but if you're under anger, you tend to downgrade risks and believe you can retaliate. And sometimes political entrepreneurs wish to inculcate anger if they want to get a violent spiral going between actors. Sometimes they wish to generate fear if they want, especially ethnic cleansing in my cases, if you want to, the other side doesn't believe that they can keep themselves safe, you will separate and you'll get ethnically homogenous groups. So I've spent a lot of years looking to see how political leaders mobilize basically five emotions: fear, anger, contempt, hatred, and resentment. And they would do different things to generate one of those emotions in order to try to mobilize different types of political behavior.
So can you give us an example that really will elucidate for listeners how this actually works, like a concrete example?
If people remember what happened in Kosovo, the Serbs did a massive ethnic cleansing of Albanians, but the Albanians came in after that, and they started, even under Western supervision, they started wanting to intimidate Serbs to leave Kosovo. And really, there are no Serbs left in any of the major five cities in Kosovo today, south of the Ibar River. And if you want, say, in a village, and I was living in some of these villages, if they wanted to create fear, they would leave what they call night letters. They leave a note in the box saying that we have a list of people we're going to go after, and you're number two on the list. When you don't know who put the letter there, where it's coming from, you know, what's going to happen to you or your family, that's a way to generate fear in an opponent, and then the only solution for them was to leave Kosovo. Now, if you were in a situation where you want to create a violent spiral, and before, in 1998, Albanians sort of believed that, in Kosovo, believed that the West was not going to intervene on their side unless violence happened. And so they decided we needed to get a violent spiral, and they hit and attacked certain Serbian policemen, and they attacked the police, not the army, not the other more professional forces. they would attack them in a way, and they would say, we, the Kosovo Liberation Army, killed a couple of your policemen. And they knew that this was going to generate a backlash because their belief was these Serbian policemen could not control themselves. They would escalate the conflict and generate a violence level which would trigger Western intervention. So in the one case where the Albanian actors had sort of already won and wanted to sort of create ethnic cleansing, they were creating fear, and by sort of anonymous, sort of, you don't know where the attack might come from. And in the other case, it was, we attack you, you think we're inferior, but the inferior people just killed a couple of your people, and that generated the massacres at Rochuk and other places where the United States decided they had to intervene. So those are a couple examples about how political actors actually calculated, we want to get a certain kind of emotion, and that's going to basically motivate the behaviors they want.
And then on the other side, of course, they took the narrative and framed it in a different way in order to get a reaction from that side.
Yeah, but I think that especially in these conflict situations, there's a lot of material that you can sort of work with. But I think fear and anger, you build on violence, and you use violence in certain ways. Contempt is an emotion that the other side is really deeply inferior to you. And I think in that case, violence isn't a really good tool, but you build on sort of other cultural understandings and cultural schemas.
Let's bring in David Altide. David Altide also studies emotion, specifically fear, and how the politics of fear come about through framing in mass media. So the government using certain frames, and then the mass media just disseminating those frames. Talk about the framing and how certain frames might emerge.
I think that one of the key questions is how we actually decide for audiences which steps we should take. And a big part of that is what we call, how is a situation defined? And framing sets that very clearly. For me, one of the biggest examples when we talk about 9/11 was when it started. How would we frame these attacks? Indeed, even the word attack suggests kind of a frame. You know, how would we define planes running into those buildings? Initially, some of the statements were that, well, these are criminal acts. But then pretty quickly that changed to, well, no, they're not criminal acts, they are terrorist acts. And so the difference between a crime and an act of terrorism becomes really significant, because terrorism carries with it, you know, all sorts of other massive state kinds of reactions. And terrorism also, as a term in our society, has a real history with it and some very heavy connotations, meaning things are going to be pretty random, you can't predict anything, there's this powerful but invisible enemy. And so because of that, we then have to take some very strong preventive actions early on in order to stop potential terrorists. And that in turn led to all kinds of things that Jeff might talk a bit more about later, various kinds of acts of surveillance and preventive detention and so forth, not to mention the kind of armed reaction invasion of countries and what have you. So that basic framing becomes really significant. We find fascinating about the media is that, to some extent, unlike the situation that Roger just really clearly described with the Balkans, the American situation with terrorism was much different, and it really pretty much depended on the mass media. The situation Roger's been studying, the media play a part, but it's much different because in that part of the world, the people involved in the various wars and so forth have a long history of experience and information about themselves compared to their counterparts, the other ethnic groups. And some of that goes back, as I'm sure Roger knows better than any of us probably, for centuries about atrocities and so forth. For more and more of the world, in terms of terrorism, the mass media are the source of the experience and how these things are framed and set up. And so when that happens, then I think the media play a very strong role in promoting actually fear first, and then out of fear comes a sense of danger, and then, for I think most people, as media audiences, anger comes out of the sense of fear about, you know, what's threatening us and what we may or may not be able to do about it, and therefore I'm angry at them and we must then take some retaliatory action, and then we get into the whole propaganda spiral of sort of framing these enemies in certain very simple ways, justifying actions that we're going to take to protect us. And it's always cast with the notion that whatever we do, we can't do too much in order to keep us safe from these people that we're angry at. And I think that's where the current approach in the world with terrorism has gotten us now, where we're engaged in so much kinds of preventive action, retaliatory action, in order to keep us safe from things that might happen in the future.
I think one of the interesting things that is emerging from the focus now on emotions and political psychology and this merging with political communication is that two things are occurring. One is in the frame, there becomes this kind of good guys and bad guys, the us and the them frame, and that kind of, shall we say, instigates a different kind of social psychology. And then you get this framing of the emotions, which, as Roger talks about in his book, has an automatic behavioral mechanism that sort of kicks in like a little trigger. Perhaps that's a good place to bring in Jeff Birkenstein.
So far, it's a very interesting discussion, and I like the connections between Serbia, which was very interesting for me. I was teaching as a graduate student at the University of Kentucky when the United States and NATO went into Serbia, and one of my best friends, well, she is from Belgrade, she is a Serb, and she came and spoke to my class, and it was just very interesting. We didn't know what to do with it, but it was very interesting to get a very different perspective than our media was then giving. One thing that's really interesting, and I think what David is mentioning, really makes me think about the role of media, even from the maybe first couple hours of 9/11. One of the things I think when you ask people, they have this common experience of 9/11 and the events, because if you were outside of the New York or D.C. or Shanksville or whatever it was, Pennsylvania, forget the name, but of the Pennsylvania area, if you were outside of the immediate impact area, you watched it on television, and everybody watched it on television. So we had sort of this common perception. But what's fascinating is thinking, especially about your book, Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, it was almost sort of a reflexive decision that was not nefarious, that probably wasn't an ulterior motive. But if you remember, even from the very beginning, the media, which we tend to believe in our memory, was sort of just, they turned on the cameras and showed us what happened. You remember the example of what's come to be known as the falling man, in other words, people jumping and or falling from the World Trade Center. Well, in the very beginning of the coverage of the attacks, we heard and we saw and people discussed it, and there was even a couple scenes where you saw people fall. But even within the first couple of hours, not as a coordinated effort, but someone who had control of the TV cameras and or what was being shown through the TV was not giving us those images. So even after the first couple hours, those images were being taken away from us. It was a way of protecting us in a way that is unfortunate, I think. And that, to me, is really interesting, just in terms of what David's talking about in terms of media and promoting fear and then anger, because there was a situation where there was this raw data, if an image of a person falling is can be considered raw data. And it was so raw that there was a reflexive image to cut it off, because you didn't know what would happen when people saw it. And then over time, you know, then very quickly it got into the meme in terms of the frame of 3,000 dead Americans. In fact, I still cringe when I hear that today. I heard it just the other day on a talk news show. Someone said, well, 3,000 dead Americans on 9/11. But we really know that it wasn't 3,000 dead Americans. It was around 3,000 people, many of whom were not from the United States. And so just this way of almost reflexive gut-level framing is extremely influential. And then it does lead to the idea of anger and how people can be controlled in terms of what our response is, et cetera.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders, Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues. And I'm Maria Armudian. We are speaking with Roger Peterson, David Altide, and Jeff Birkenstein. Roger Peterson is a professor of political science at MIT. His books include Understanding Ethnic Conflict. David Altide is professor of political communication at Arizona State University, and his books include Terrorism and the Politics of Fear, and Jeff Birkenstein, professor of English at St. Martin's University, and his latest book is Reframing 9/11. Roger Peterson, let's talk about the idea that things are unjust or unjust. It seemed universal in the conflicts that you looked at, that the framing of this is unfair tended to be underlying all the conflict. And those people are doing something or are going to do something that harms us.
Yeah. Let me first just to mention what Jeff is just talking about, though, because I think this is sort of interesting. I hadn't thought about the body, but, you know, a lot of emotion theorists often talk about the cognitive antecedents. What are the beliefs that generate the emotion, and then what's the action tendency of that emotion? If you're under anger, the belief is an identifiable person has done something wrong to you. The action tendency is quite clear. It is to punish that person. Now, fear, though, is a little tricky because the belief is clear that I'm in a situation of danger, but the action tendency could be either fight or flight. There's some speculation. We don't understand this very well. Maybe Jeff and Dave understand better than I do, but I think the framing of the situation, if I am powerless and that's the source of danger, then I flee, then I have flight. But if the perception of danger is the danger is coming from someone who has power, but I also have power, then the action tendency is to fight back. I think the image of a body falling is really a helpless, powerless image, which everyone sort of intuitively understands this is sort of like fleeing. And I think that the media and probably everybody else didn't want that. They realized relatively quickly that we need to fight back, and we can't look so powerless as this body falling down. I think you're picking up on this other emotion, which is of resentment. And the cognitive antecedent, the belief that generates the emotion of resentment, is that my group of people is in an unfair position on a status hierarchy. I think there's a lot of psychology that people think in terms of groups and in terms of group hierarchies. And like in Iraq, the Sunnis had been on top all the time. We came in, the Shia were going to control the country and the democracy by this their raw numbers, and we didn't anticipate at all the power of the resentment of Sunni Arabs to not be able to adjust to not being on top of a hierarchy. In Eastern Europe, because these were empires that crumbled, you had these group hierarchies that were changing. And status reversals are very powerful and very ubiquitous sort of part of politics, which creates this feeling of injustice that you said. And this is another type of powerful motivator. And, of course, politicians who are smart concentrate sometimes. If they think they can get out of the violence game because the resentment is so powerful of another group, then they will have speeches and parades that highlight the status discrepancies.
Well, wouldn't you say that the resentment is wrapped up with anger in a way, in the way that David Altide was talking about fear and anger? First there's fear, then there's anger. You know, this was unfair. They did this to us. This is unjust. And that narrative that fuels it, and that is what is then fueling the larger wars, even, say, perhaps the United States then attacking, well, first Afghanistan and then Iraq.
Well, I think the feeling that, you know, my group doesn't get what it deserves and this resentment, that makes it easier to use anger. But I think the idea about really talking about emotions in a productive way is to try to be very specific about what they're framing, what the beliefs behind them are. And I think it's a different idea that my group is in a inferior status position, which is resentment, and anger, which is somebody has really done something specifically bad against my group, and there has to be some type of punishment for that.
David Altine?
Yeah, I think that this starts getting at some of the nub of some real differences in the world. I think one of the other very strong emotions that a lot of us have spent a little time looking at, in addition to resentment, is entitlement. And the notion that we are more deserving than others, that a certain way that we want things is how the world really should work. And so if something has happened that symbolically kind of challenges it, that becomes very important. Because one of the other concepts here that's connected to emotions, but has a bit more to do with how we act in the world, is identity, or how do we see ourselves as being known by others? You know, what do others think of us? And if you feel entitled to a certain approach in the world, how dare anyone possibly oppose us, for example? Or how dare anyone in any nation challenge our particular God? Or how could anyone dare do certain things that we have been given, if you will, God-given rights to, constitutional right to, and so forth? Those things can then become very powerful in the sense of triggering these other things, that you're taking something from us. I'm worried about losing my rightful place here, and so forth. I remember just briefly after 9/11, for example, and again, that's much of my focus is, was on the term that a lot of people were saying, Americans have lost their swagger, and that's why some of these actions dare happen. We're entitled to sort of rule and dominate in a certain way, and this sort of thing is not viewed universally in the world that way by all cultures, obviously, but I think certain political systems really tend to promote this as a justification for hegemonic rule.
Jeff Birkenstein?
Well, this is so interesting what David is saying. I mean, his article, for instance, in the book, Reframing 9/11, is Fear, Terrorism, and Popular Culture. And if we remember post-9/11, there was a big chunk of the country, myself included, who wanted to ask what seemed like a simple question is, why did they do this to us? But at the time, that was a very problematic question because it went outside the frame. The frame was, well, they're animals, they're terrorists, they're bad people. I think George Bush said something along the line, they hate us for our freedom. That might be a paraphrasing. It's been so twisted at this point. But that was the response. And so to ask the question is, well, let's take a look at this. Why, from their perspective, not accepting it, agreeing with it, or condoning it, but why did they attack us? And that question was very problematic. And a lot of people wanted to seek out that information for their own benefit. But the response through the media that really was quite a ringleader in terms of a certain kind of reaction that the American people should have, that was really outside the bounds of acceptable questions at the time. You still had a desire from a lot of people to ask that question, so they were asking it in other ways. One of the ways is through popular culture. They would ask it directly or indirectly in alternate methods, maybe not through the media, or maybe not through what Sarah Palin calls the lamestream media, but all sorts of other avenues. Because people desire information. But at the same time, there's always people who don't want to seek out this information, and that's quite a conflict right there. And that gets right to the sense of entitlement that Americans had, and how could they do this to us? Because we, many people say, are a beneficent power. We're a beneficent presence. We're the greatest country in the world, et cetera. All of these sort of slogans we've been hearing for a long time. Those came under attack. And the last thing the media and many politicians wanted to hear, have asked, is, well, why did they do this to us?
That response was also framed in a very distinct way. Roger Peterson, would you like to respond?
If the enemy is just inherently defective, there are different emotions. I think hatred and contempt come into play there. But if the enemy is not inherently defective, but for some other reason did bad things to us, then we're angry, we need to punish them, but I think the struggle is a little different. If you hate someone, the tendency is to physically eliminate their presence. If you're angry, you just need to punish them. And so it's sort of interesting about how Americans frame these terrorists. Are they a small group? Do they actually have reasons? But once you get into reasons, then we can't hate them, and mm-hmm. we can't have these campaigns to try to eliminate them as much. So I think there was a lot of that going on. I think Bill Maher, right, he said something about the terrorists that flew the planes in were had some measure of courage or something, and then he had to leave the air because he couldn't attribute.
They may have been a lot of things, Bill Maher said, but they weren't cowards.
Right. And to say even a statement like that, which I don't think is even that controversial necessarily, to attribute anything good to this at the time inherently defective enemy, that generates an emotion. But, of course, if we get into Iraq, we have to say, well, I think George Bush said Islam is a religion of peace, and he has to go out to try to not have that framing because those emotions become counterproductive at another time.
This is David Altaiti again. One of the things you have to do in order to generate a certain response from your audience and to generate a response that the audience seems appropriate and therefore see you as a leader is you've got to be able to tap some key emotions, and it becomes a real challenge, and so you've got to define things in a certain way. One way that we help do this is through controlling language. and using certain words, Jeff kind of suggested, all but banning the use of other words. And so the language starts changing. Let me give you an example. The United States, and we're not the first country to do this, of course, but the United States in both of these wars with Afghanistan and Iraq has paid a large number of people to help us fight these wars. Historically, in the past, when you pay somebody to fight your war for you, that is to say they're not your own soldiers, they're people who are fighting for pay, we've called those mercenaries. Well, mercenary has a very bad connotation to it. Mercenaries, in the way we've read history and been taught it, mercenary is something that other countries sometimes do, and it's really vulgar and, if not immoral, to pay somebody to fight your wars. Well, the United States, including the various companies that we paid to fight these wars, has continued to deny that they're mercenaries. And very few of our political leaders ever refer to these folks as mercenaries. And in some ways, it would be refreshing if somebody would say, well, yeah, we're using mercenaries, but, you know, it's cheaper this way, or so what? And just get on with it and then let people deal with that. So they're not mercenaries. They're the contractors, they're consultants, and so forth. Because, again, mercenaries suggest a certain definition of a situation, and a country such as ours is entitled to certain things because, historically, most countries and most groups see themselves as morally superior to the people they're fighting. This is true almost universally. You know, language helps do that in some very important ways.
Well, we are out of time now, but let me just remind listeners that we are speaking with Roger Peterson, David Altide, and Jeff Birkenstein. Roger Peterson is a professor of political science at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His books include Understanding Ethnic Conflict and Resistance and Rebellion: Lessons from Eastern Europe. David Altide is professor of political communication at Arizona State University, and his books include Terror Post 9/11 in the Media, Terrorism in the Politics of Fear, and Creating Fear, News in the Construction of Crisis. And Jeff Birkenstein, professor of English at St. Martin's University, and his latest book is Reframing 9/11. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you, everybody. Great discussion.
That's it for today's show. I'd like to thank all of our guests and our producers, Ankine Aghasyan and Melissa Shiprin, and our assistant producers, Ishmael Karim and Carlson Dezuris. If you missed a part of this show, you can always go back to the kpfk.org archives and listen. You can always podcast us, and you can keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @armudian. We'll see you next week.